What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
You're about to watch what we call an extended clip of the Young Turks. And the reality is it's somewhere in the middle. It's a little longer than our YouTube clips, but it's actually shorter than the whole 2-hour show, which you can get if you're a member. You can get it ad-free, and make sure you catch every news story we do that day. You're going to love it as a full show. That's at tytnetwork.com/join. Thanks for watching.
Oh, well, that was a really abrupt entry back into the show, but this is a, you know, it's Friday. We don't have any time. We got to do the show. But we've got a full power panel here for you. Before we get back into the news, though, I did want to remind you, if you have not already downloaded our app, which, by the way, is apparently doing incredibly well, it is available on iOS. You can also go to tyt.com/app to download it. And it is a good central point for member content, free content, audio, video, everything. And I've been getting some really good feedback about it on Twitter as well.
I love it. I gotta be honest.
I'm waiting for the Android release, but for those of you on iOS, which I understand is the vast majority of everybody, everybody seems to love it. And now that it's been out there and people have had a chance to use it, I would like you to tweet me at John Iderola what you like about the app, what you're using it for, how it's changing your ability to sort of consume our content. And maybe I'll read some of those tweets a little bit later on. With that said, though, let's jump back into the news. Donald Trump is off overseas at the G7, and our allies are doing what they can to defuse this brewing trade war that he's gotten us into. Just to be clear, when I say our allies, I mean most of our allies, not his allies, since he doesn't seem to like most of them very much. In advance of the G7, he tweeted this: looking forward to straightening out unfair trade deals with the G7 countries. If it doesn't happen, we come out even better.
How does that work?
If that's the case, then why are you doing it, you nincompoop? But that's what he's going to say, of course. And he goes there and he punches Macron in the face and he punches Merkel in the face and all of that. There are people there, though, that he does like, or people he'd like to be there. So why don't we turn to one of his first requests at the G7, which you'll see here.
We have a world to run. And in the G7, which used to be the G8, they threw Russia out. They should let Russia come back in, because we should have Russia at the negotiating table.
Some might argue that they're already well represented there, but look, he would like to make it the G8 once again. I would like to just fill out the history of this if you're not familiar with how the numbers got moved around. Russia joined the group in the 1990s after emerging from the wreckage of the Soviet Union, making it the G8. But its armed intervention in neighboring Ukraine in 2014 and seizure of the Crimean Peninsula angered other major powers. The remaining members, led by President Barack Obama, expelled it in a sign of global resolve not to let international borders be redrawn by force. Mr. Trump offered no specific reasoning for why Russia should be let back in, even though it retains control of Crimea and has not adhered to an international agreement to end its intervention in eastern Ukraine.
So
there's more to what he's doing at the G7, but his first big request is to expand its roster slightly.
So I just wanted to add a little bit more context, and this is actually news that we talked about on yesterday's show. So Putin was recently addressing the people of Russia, and he also was essentially addressing other countries internationally for being allies of the United States. And so he essentially poked fun or taunted US allies for doing business with the United States and said something along the lines of, what did I tell you? You do business with the United States, what are you gonna get? You get these tariffs, which he likened to sanctions. So he's been criticizing the United States pretty aggressively. And to me, what it does is it messages that Trump is the perfect candidate, or the perfect president, I should say, for someone like Putin, who really wants to dominate the world stage and wants to kind of get the upper hand over the United States, right?
It's pretty easy to get the upper hand over Donald Trump.
Exactly right. And now we have Trump saying, like, you know, Russia should be at the table. I don't know why he adds an R at the end of Russia. But anyway,
what's interesting is that, well, first of all, we have imposed sanctions. We are currently in a policy of sanctions by his own administration, by his own Treasury Secretary, who announced this back in April. We have expanded our sanctions against Russia. So he didn't get that memo. Okay, if you didn't read it, whatever. I just want to just go back to the fact that he was concerned about deals with the G7 countries, because that implies to me that he did not realize that we are technically one of the seven countries in the G7. Mm-hmm. That's just a math thing, but there's actually a G6, if he's being accurate, about the countries with which he is invoking trade wars, which is all of them.
That's right.
The ministers of finance, the treasury secretaries and so forth from the G7 met before this meeting. This is the leaders. Before that, the financial leaders met, and six out of seven of them, the seventh being us, basically were opposed to all of the trade wars that Trump has started, that they have retaliated against, and that will continue to spiral upward. Every single one of them declared in some manner that it feels like the G6 plus one.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah. Yeah, I want to talk more about the odd relationship between us and our allies versus Trump and those who are not our natural allies. But John McCain actually put out a statement about this announcement that Trump put out, and it talks a little bit about that. So I want to read an excerpt from his press release. John McCain said, "Vladimir Putin chose to make Russia unworthy of membership in the G8 by invading Ukraine and annexing Crimea. Nothing he has done since then has changed that most obvious fact. Every day, Russian-led separatist forces are killing Ukrainians in the Donbas. Every day, Putin's forces are helping the Assad regime slaughter the Syrian people. And every day, through assassinations, cyber attacks, and malign influence, Russia is assaulting democratic institutions all over the world. The president has inexplicably shown our adversaries the deference and esteem that should be reserved for our closest allies. Those nations that share our values and have sacrificed alongside us for decades are being treated with contempt." Is interesting, really fast. It's interesting that, like, in his talks with Trudeau recently, or Macron, or Merkel, who he doesn't seem to have liked even as much as he liked them, like, these people who are natural allies, naturally he goes after and he attacks. The people who are authoritarian leaders around the world, as Bernie Sanders pointed out recently, he just feels this natural kinship for. And you might say, well, they're flattering him. But the thing is, as Anna pointed out, I mean, Russia was recently sort of taunting Trump over his trade problems with his allies. Mm-hmm. And that leads to him wanting them to join the G7 to make it the G8. But when he just had a contentious talk with Macron over trade, he got pissed at him. When he talked with Trudeau and he didn't like the criticism, he got pissed at him. Mm-hmm. So why is it that with our allies, when they criticism, he reacts negatively, but when it's authoritarian rulers, he's fine with it?
Maybe he just has some sort of affection for them. But I think that there might be more at play. And also, considering the fact that he's in the middle of this investigation, which he can't stop himself from tweeting about, it's probably not a great idea. As Emma said during the break, it's not a good idea for you to out of nowhere mention that Russia should be involved, you know, in this group of allies, that it should be the G8 again. It's kind of insane.
Yeah, he doesn't really have the mental block to know, wait, they're in the news cycle, they're talking about how I'm in Putin's back pocket. Maybe I shouldn't out of nowhere, unprompted, with no policy position behind it, say that Russia should be back into the G8, make it the G8 again. But just a side note about John McCain, I wish that he would hold the United States to the same standard that he holds other countries to. He's not making the same argument that the United States should be expelled from the G7 because we are currently helping the Saudi blockade in Yemen, et cetera. So I just want to take John McCain's comments with a grain of salt, because often it's just ramping up us up towards more war, more aggression, et cetera. And he often doesn't have policy behind it. He likes to criticize Donald Trump in public and then vote for him in private.
Did you want to say something about that?
Well, no, just back to the G8 and the whole Russia versus the G6, the rest of our allies. I mean, you know, maybe the fact is that we actually have trade agreements with all of these nations, in addition to being part of the full G7 bloc. Yeah. We actually have sanctions against Russia.
That's right.
So it's a very bizarre sort of anti-Machiavellian. It's very strange.
And also, I mean, if he had a reason, if he could actually point to how this would benefit the American people, then okay. But these, you know, the way that we're treating our allies and the tariffs on aluminum and steel are actually going to negatively impact employers, more importantly, employees and consumers in the United States. So I don't understand why he's doing this with, again, our longest serving allies. It just doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you're not remotely interested in the Russia angle of this, and you think that countries that invade and seize territory should be allowed in with that, no conditions on them, remember that we're talking about him going there, punching our allies in the face, and we are going to lose hundreds of thousands, if not potentially millions of jobs as a result of it.
What is it a good idea to get involved in a trade war with Europe? What president would think that, except for Trump?
Yeah. Right. Well, the last time that happened, we had a Great Depression throughout the world. The last time we had an isolationist policy was in the 1920s, in the wake of World War I, and that ultimately unleashed a global depression and World War II.
Yeah. I'm sure
so
Trump
that's
knows
what
that.
Happened.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Okay,
I'm sure he studied that.
Yeah. He studied that.
He's a well-versed historian, the best historian.
And he can count.
Tremendous historian.
Okay, let's turn to a different topic right now. Trump, we all know that Trump doesn't like leakers. He doesn't like the leaking, and he said that he's going to do something about it. Well, it looks like we've entered a new phase of that with the Justice Department cracking down on a suspected leaker. A former aide to the Senate Intelligence Committee was arrested for allegedly lying to the FBI about communications with a New York Times reporter. That is, as this graphic is saying, James A. Wolf, charged with lying repeatedly to investigators about his contacts with three separate reporters. According to the authorities, Mr. Wolf made false statements to the FBI about providing two of them with sensitive information related to the committee's work. He denied to investigators that he ever gave classified material to journalists. The seizure was disclosed in a letter to the Times reporter Ali Watkins, who had been in a three-year relationship with Mr. Wolf. And we have some more details about how exactly this relationship between Wolf and these journalists went down. Court documents describe Mr. Wolf's communications with actually four reporters, including Ms. Watkins, using encrypted messaging applications that either aren't as encrypted as we thought they were, or he wasn't using them properly. It appeared that the FBI was investigating how Mrs. Watkins learned that Russian spies in 2013 had tried to recruit Carter Page, former Trump foreign policy advisor. She published an article for BuzzFeed News about that, about the attempted recruitment of Mr. Page, in which she confirmed the contacts. FBI agents initially approached Ms. Watkins about the relationship she had with Mr. Wolf, saying they were investigating unauthorized leaks. The Justice Department told her in a letter sent in February that her records had been seized. But that is the relationship that we have the most details about, but it was not the only one. In another case, the indictment said Mr. Wolf used an encrypted messaging app to alert another reporter in October 2017 that he had served Mr. Page with a subpoena to testify before the committee. And that same month, Mr. Wolf reached out to a third reporter on the same unidentified app to offer to serve as an unnamed source, according to documents. So there's still more for us to learn about this. We'll have a little bit more later on. But understand that they apparently several months ago seized all these communications from the Times reporter, which is not necessarily unprecedented in recent history coming out of the White House. But it is a ramping up of this war against leaking.
War against whistleblowers that President Obama started. I mean, President Obama was way more aggressive against whistleblowers than Bush ever was. It was one of the most disappointing aspects of President Obama's tenure as president. And now, according to the New York Times, Jeff Sessions and the Justice Department under Donald Trump are doing three times as many as Obama was at the end of his term. So this is a bipartisan war on whistleblowers. And they're an easy target because they had this weird relationship, I guess, a relationship between the journalist and the leaker. So it makes it easier for Jeff Sessions to go after them. It's not, you know, it's not Edward Snowden. It's not Chelsea Manning. This isn't a case that involves major, major policy implications. But it is indicative of a larger trend that I think is bipartisan and a little bit troubling to me.
Yeah, yesterday we were talking about how ICE officials have contracted with a company to do widespread surveillance in the United States, you know, in an effort to catch undocumented immigrants. But it gives them a lot of, you know, just a broad power. And when we were talking about that story, I made the argument, and the same argument applies here, that when you're a Democrat who got elected as president and you lay the groundwork or you expand your powers to do this type of stuff, to do this type of behavior, well then who's to say the person who gets elected after you, who might actually be a terrible person, wouldn't you know, use that to his advantage and expand it even further? And that's what we're going to get with the Trump administration. Of course they're going to go after whistleblowers and leakers aggressively, especially in this administration where there has been at least one leak a day in regard to what the administration is doing behind the scenes.
Right, and it's also it's a war with the press. I mean, it's a war with reporters and it's a war with whistleblowers, and it is something that, you know, obviously they're very comfortable doing. And I think the fact that, you know, they've only started and they're already like well beyond the sort of amounts of the Obama administration is very telling for what's going to happen going forward. It's where there's a retaining of sort of power to restrict effectively the First Amendment.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I would, I guess in a very real sense, I would consider us lucky that they haven't done more since, considering how many times he promised during the campaign to, to tighten the libel laws and all of that, and his obviously lifelong hatred for the media, at least the media that's not currently talking to him and about him in the way that he wants. But the depressing thing is the particular type of leak that we had here. So it had to do with Carter Page, which means that this person was leaking to provide information about some of the nefarious elements of Donald Trump's campaign, which means that we can be sure that the right wing is not going to say a peep about this. And they're not going to care about it because they don't want those leaks to happen. And it scares me that our country, so much of the media and those who comment on these sort of things have broken up into two groups where it's either you will report on it only if it's Donald Trump, and you won't mention that up until like the early part of his second term, Obama had done some things like this. He didn't do it in the later part of his second term, but he still did do it at one point. We acknowledge that. Some people will only talk about Donald Trump's offense and not acknowledge the historical precedent for it, and some will only mention this as a route to do an what about Obama thing.
That's such a good point.
And that's insane. Yeah. We have to acknowledge both, and we have to keep both accountable.
I think you're so right, and I remember, you know, the treatment toward Edward Snowden or the treatment toward Chelsea Manning under Obama's watch was hideous, and it was something that we talked about on a regular basis. And this is not a partisan issue. If you genuinely care about the Constitution and the First Amendment, then you can't be disingenuous and you know, be one-sided in your coverage or in your outrage about it, right? So if you're outraged under the Obama administration, you should be as equally outraged right now considering what the Trump administration is doing. Because really, this is not a partisan issue. This is not about Democrat versus Republican, conservative versus liberal or progressive. This is all about making sure that journalists are able to do their jobs, and those who provide journalists with information that we should know about are protected.
Yeah.
And it's disturbing that other journalists aren't focusing on this enough. They didn't focus on it enough under President Obama because he was charismatic and, by all accounts, in his individual personal life, a really good guy, and he had a decent relationship with the Washington Press Corps. But now, because it's Trump and it's an ugly face on it and he is vulgar and gross, now more people are discussing it. But again, it's not being discussed enough. Journalists should be protecting other journalists at all costs, all the time.
That's right. And the fact that the story came out but hasn't had that attention that it should get from all of the media field is really scary.
It is scary because I just feel like we're inching closer and closer to a society where people are going to be afraid to speak out. Mm-hmm. The whole point, and by the way, the assault on journalists during the Trump administration so far has been pretty transparent. I mean, he's talked about taking credentials away from people who criticize him or write about him in a critical way. And by the way, we're talking about establishment media outlets like the Washington Post and the New York Times. They don't go out of their way, at least traditionally, to tear politicians apart. Usually they try to be as friendly as possible because they want access to that person. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we start tearing down news organizations like that, imagine what would happen to independent news organizations who actually do very aggressively criticize someone like Trump.
Yeah. My worry is that this will be talked about, but it'll be talked about amongst Trump's base and they'll love it. Because the thing is, like Obama making the moves that he did is scary because of the expansion of executive power. But it didn't rest on a foundation of the media is fake, news isn't real, there is no truth. That's the world that we're living in right now, where InfoWars is a more credible news source than the Washington Post. And that's what almost everyone in government seems to believe. And I don't know. Again, I think that we're lucky that we've gotten this far right now without him cracking down more on the press. And I wonder, what will there be left by the time his second term ends, if it comes to that?
Do you think that Wolf used the same encrypted messaging app, WhatsApp, as Manafort?
I don't know. Is that what is
I'm just guessing. I keep referring to it as Signal,
right. Which I'm not familiar with, actually. There's a few encrypted ones that I've used, but that's not one of them. And I could be wrong. Check that before assuming that that's the case. Anyway, okay, we are going to take another break, but when we come back, we're going to turn to the environment and Canada. Things aren't looking good for either of them. We'll be back after this.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. You're only halfway through, so hold, stay right here. Just want to remind you, if you want to get all 5 segments of the Young Turks commercial free, these are just 2 of them. Every day we do it. So go to tytnetwork.com/join, and you'll get the whole 5 segments, 2 hours, ad free. Do it now.
Everyone, is it time to drop it?
At TYT, we frequently talk about all the ways that big tech companies are taking control of our online lives, constantly monitoring us and storing and selling our data. But that doesn't mean we have to let them. It's possible to stay anonymous online and hide your data from the prying eyes of big tech. And one of the best ways is with ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN hides your IP address, making your active ID more difficult to trace and sell to advertisers. ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your network data to protect you from eavesdroppers and cyber criminals. And it's also easy to install. A single mouse click protects all your devices. But listen, guys, this is important. ExpressVPN is rated #1 by CNET and Wired magazine. So take back control of your life online and secure your data with a top VPN solution available, ExpressVPN. And if you go to expressvpn.com/TYT, you can get 3 extra months for free with this exclusive link just for TYT fans. That's expressvpn.com/TYT. Check it out today.
What's up? I've been on the show. You know who I am. But we have a whole new panel, and I'm very excited about it. Ida Rodriguez, Brett Ehrlich, you've all met them. And I'm super happy that you guys are back. But we have a new guest host today, Ravneet Vohra. She is the founder and editor-in-chief of Wear Your Voice magazine, a highly acclaimed, innovative digital publication that has reached huge international success. Ravneet, tell us a little bit more about your magazine.
I founded it about 4 years ago. It's on intersectional feminism, so we're prioritizing the voices of women of color and people of color, talking about gender, sexuality, race, culture, etc.
I love that. Yeah. Traditionally, feminism has left women of color out of the conversation.
Yes.
And I think it's important to kind of discuss, you know, the more unique obstacles that women of color have to deal with. And so, by the way, we have 2 pretty hardcore feminists on the show today, which is awesome.
So
and
you
then
guys
Brett,
are too,
Brett's on too.
What? I thought I was a hardcore feminist.
No.
Fine.
Awesome.
Okay, I'll take the other side of it today.
So thank you for joining us. And I apologize that we start off with little bit of a depressing story, and honestly, I kind of want to rush through it because it's hard for me to report on it. But with that said, let's get started.
Celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain has died at the pass at the age of 61 from an apparent suicide. He was discovered in his hotel room in France, and he was actually in France to tape an episode of his hit CNN show, Parts Unknown. Now, Eric Rippert, a celebrity chef and a celebrity chef who was also a good friend of his, appeared with Bourdain on several of his shows and found him unresponsive. Gladys Bourdain, who was a longtime editor of the New York Times, said she had no indication that her son might have been thinking of suicide. She said, "He is absolutely the last person in the world I would have ever dreamed would do something like this." And that was the reaction of a lot of people, although those who were extremely close to him said that it did seem as though things were a little off. And you know, before we get into more details about this story, I just really want to emphasize for anyone who's watching, anyone who might be struggling with mental health issues, depression, anxiety, please, please, please get help. Please get help. You're not alone. A lot of people all over the world are suffering from this as well. And there is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. If you want to call and get help, it's 1-800-273-8255. Let's put up graphic 41. Again, the number is 1-800-273-8255. So this has been a really hard story for me, and I've never responded or reacted this way to the passing of a celebrity, but Anthony Bourdain had a huge impact on my life, and I'm now learning on the lives of a lot of other people. And it's just a devastating story, and yeah.
Very responsible for, it's weird. It's weird to say, like, he changed food television, but it's not like food television. He changed a lot of the role that food plays in a lot of people's lives now can trace directly back to his effect on it. From, you know, it used to be, I mean, I work in television, so it's like, I used to be cooking shows where just people like Emeril Lagasse yelling bam and throwing spice on things. But I can't even look at it. Yeah, yeah. And he changed it. He added a voice, a personal relationship with not just the food, but the chefs, the people behind it, and culture. Part of culture is food, right? Mm. But he brought other parts of culture into the discussion of food and brought food into the other parts of the discussion of culture. And I know, and we do the Happy Half Hour, a new show that was on today, and there's one segment in particular where I'm doing an impression. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just, it sucks. Like, I'm doing an impression of, like, how he talks about food. I'm talking about drinks, and it's weird, but it's... It's just really intense, and it's so unexpected.
It is.
It's a guy walking around talking about sea urchin.
But then that's how suicide plays out. It's never really anything that anyone expects. And, you know, for me, it was so shocking because, you know, we're in 1 week, we've had two deaths amongst white communities with privilege, with access, with healthcare. And now I just want to think about the fact that what's happening in our marginalized communities and what is being unseen. And I know, being from a South Asian community and talking on behalf of the black and brown community as a whole, we have a lot of stigma around mental health.
Yes.
And we don't get the help we need because we're always told to sort of be more positive, back up, you know, you can get through it, you know, push through. But really, it's such a huge health issue. But accessibility is one of the biggest things in the black and brown community. How are we going to help them push through? Because these were people with privilege.
Yeah,
you know, they had everything. And yet, they had to go in this way.
So two things that I want to mention that I think need to be discussed, and it needs to be a little more widespread. First of all, everyone keeps talking about, oh my God, this is so unexpected. And same with Kate Spade, you know, her life seems so perfect. Anthony Bourdain, his life seems so perfect. Mm-hmm. He had it all. How could this happen? I really want to emphasize that people's public lives and what you see on social media is not representative of what is really happening in their lives. It's just not. Mm-hmm. I remember in 2016, you know, just going back to what you said about stigma, 2016 was a very difficult time for me personally, and it was the first time I dealt with depression and severe anxiety. And I opened up about it on the show. And I did not expect people to respond to me with gratitude because of the stigma. I get attacked all the time, so I kind of share things about myself without caring what other people are gonna think, without worrying about stigma. That is my privilege, you know, mm-hmm. not having that worry. But I had no idea that people felt like they couldn't talk about their mental health issues, that they couldn't open up and seek the help that they need because they were worried they would be stigmatized. Yeah. Please don't worry about that stigma. We need to have open conversations about depression. A lot of people suffer from it, and it doesn't matter how successful someone is or how perfect someone's life appears to be. People have real struggles behind the scenes.
Or how funny people are. So I suffer from depression, and I suffer from clinical depression, not, you know, I actually, my mom has a clinical depression, and when I talk about it, it was a really sad story to read. It's specifically about because of the times that we're in. There's so many people who have the spotlight that are using it to divide us. And when we lose someone who actually uses their platform to unite us and to highlight our differences as positives, it really does feel like a loss because, you know, all the headlines are always like Democrats and Republicans. And it's become so fashionable from everybody to just say, I belong to this group, that group is wrong. Just to have people like this who are allies to people from our Black and brown communities that go highlight, you know, our culture and say, this is great. Food brings us together. So I'm a little bit shook by it. I've been having my own bout of depression. And I'll tell you, as a stand-up comedian, people don't ever think that we are depressed, and we are some of the most depressed people on the planet, which is why we choose to make people laugh, because that makes us feel better. But, you know, money, fame, like his mom talked about him, and she said he had so much money and he was so successful. Those don't fill the void that you feel when you have mental illness and the stigma it is. I remember telling my mom that I felt depressed, and she would say, "You're not crazy. Don't say that. You're not crazy. There's nothing wrong with you. Like, snap out of it." And it's chemical, and it's not something that I can snap out of. And it's something that sometimes makes me not want to get out of bed. And just, I've been on the show and been depressed, and people are like looking and saying, "What's wrong with Ida? Why is her hair not combed?" It's because I had to struggle to get out of bed. And just being here with you guys will keep me going just another moment. So I will say to you, Black and brown young people, and I'm speaking to everyone, but specifically those of us who come from those communities where people tell you that it's something you can just get over, that you can just snap out of, and you're dealing with issues, go outside of your village if you need to, and go find the help that you need, because there are a lot of measures out there to help you, and it doesn't always have to be medication, you know.
Right, yeah. That was one of the reasons why I got a dog, and he really helped me. But it's different. I mean, I love that you mentioned clinical depression. There are different types of depression. Yeah. For some people, it is a chemical, physical problem, you know, and it needs to be addressed. And so it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. It means that again, we need to have open, honest conversations about it. If you are a public figure who is suffering from depression, you have the ability to lessen the stigma by coming forward and talking about what you've dealt with. And, you know, going back to what we were discussing in regard to Anthony Bourdain teaching people about culture, I mean, that's the reason why this has impacted me personally. I didn't know anything about Anthony Bourdain until about 2007. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was fresh out of college, had no interest in the world around me. And what I mean by that is I thought, LA is the best place in the world. Why would I want to go anywhere else? I hadn't traveled out of the country yet. And one of my good friends was about to go to Europe, and she invited me. I said, no. Why would I spend money to go anywhere else? I love it here. And at that time, I started watching Bourdain, and he sparked this curiosity in me. And just seeing him share other cultures and how beautiful the world around us really is, I mean, I was obsessed with his show. At that time, he hosted a show called No Reservations on the Travel Channel. And I remember calling my friend up and saying, I'm going to Europe with you. And that was the first time that I traveled, and I just started really taking in other cultures and appreciating them.
I wanted to share a video of Anthony Bourdain. This is one of his more recent episodes on CNN. I'm Armenian, so naturally, this was an episode that meant a lot to me personally. And so here is his recent trip to Armenia.
Genocide.
This isn't about revenge. This is about recognition.
War.
If we lose, we know that we will be destroyed, annihilated.
Earthquake.
I'm the generation who literally learned alphabet with a candlelight.
Armenia has endured a lot.
This isn't some geopolitical conflict on a map. Every family is touched.
Every day, 100 people leaves Armenia.
But it remains a place that millions of diaspora Armenians are very, very sentimental about.
I myself, I will never leave Armenia. I was born in Armenia and I will die in Armenia.
And I've been hearing it for years. When are you going to Armenia? When are you going to Armenia? When are you going to Armenia? Well, finally, I'm here.
So he's he will be missed, to say the least. All right, we should take a break, and when we come back, some more news of the day.
Thanks for watching what I hope was a lovely edition of the Young Turks. Now, you know that that is two of the five segments that we do, because that's free. We want to have you support independent media and come watch the whole show that we do every day. That's five segments overall, no ads at all. That's at tytnetwork.com/join. Come become a member. Thanks for watching either way. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Young Turks. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/tyt. I'm your host, Cenk Uygur, and I'll see you soon.